Today we're going to be in the book of Genesis, focusing on chapters 40 and 41. If you want to turn there, just as a reference, if you have your own Bibles, I'll be reading a lot of scripture reading today, a lot of retelling the story today. We've been considering Joseph, one of the main characters in the book of Genesis, a hero of faith. Joseph was a man spoken of by one of our New Testament writers in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, verse number 22, where the Hebrew writer writes regarding Joseph, by faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. Very interesting passage that we are working our way to uncovering the meaning of Joseph's faith being connected to instructions about his bones. And so we've been considering a series entitled The Many Colors of Joseph's Faith, the saga of Joseph, faith in many colors. For the past several weeks, we have explored the narrative of Joseph and his faith that carried him through adventure after adventure, setback after setback, betrayal after betrayal. Joseph's life was indeed a roller coaster of emotions, and how he was treated depended on the day. But one thing was constant throughout the story of Joseph throughout his life, and that was the Lord, God, Yahweh, was with him. The Lord was with Joseph. We see that phrase, that refrain, repeated several times throughout Joseph's story. Joseph was the 11th born son in a dysfunctional family that included deception, multiple wives, sibling rivalries, jealousy, and hatred. And at the end of the first sermon, we found Joseph right smack dab in the middle of family and baby mama drama. At the end of the second sermon, we found Joseph in a pit. He was left for dead. At the end of the third sermon, we found Joseph set up and sent to prison for a crime he didn't commit. But despite these anxious moments, despite these moments of severe tension, the story of Joseph is one where he consistently rises above those moments. And that's where we begin today as we explore the resilience of Joseph, the resilience of Joseph. Last week, we looked at the temptation of Joseph. Joseph had been sold into Egypt. He was now under the mastery of Potiphar, who was the captain of the guard. Joseph was so good at what he was doing that Potiphar, the household owner, gave Joseph, he put Joseph in control of everything. Joseph was handling everything. His wife says, the text, that Joseph being a handsome man, Potiphar's wife wanted a piece of Joseph, putting that in layman's terms. She propositioned him. He refused those propositions over and over. And then one day she got to grab a hold of his clothing, and then he ran away. She went and told people that he tried to take advantage of her, and that upset Potiphar. Potiphar throws him into the deepest, darkest jail. But while Joseph is there, he is given the responsibility of overseeing the jailers. Are you guys seeing a pattern with this? Like when he was a young boy, he was given the responsibility of overseeing his brothers. He gets into Potiphar's house and he's given a responsibility of overseeing the household, and now he's in jail and he's given a responsibility of overseeing the prisoners in the jail where he is confined. So let's pick up the story in Genesis chapter 40, starting at verse number 1. Some time after this, the cupbearer of the king of Egypt and his baker offended their lord, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and he put them in the custody of the house of the captain of the guard in the prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he waited on them, and they continued for some time in custody. One night they both dreamed, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, each his own dream, and each dream with his own meaning. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in custody in his master's house, "Why are your faces downcast today?" They said to him, "We have had dreams, and there is no one to interpret them." And Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me." From hated outcast brother to slave to accused rapist to dream interpreter, we have known Joseph as a dreamer. Part of his story is that he had these fantastical dreams of stars bowing down to his star and sheaves bowing down to his sheaves. We know him as a dreamer, but now he's in a position of dream interpretation. Let's not forget how Joseph arrived in this position. I said that last week. Resisting temptation, usually an act of fulfilling some instant, a moment of instant gratification, but resisting that temptation may afford us the opportunity to be used by God for bigger and better assignments. And here is Joseph in prison executing his gifts. Now, it might be helpful to note something here. Again, when Joseph was a teenager, Jacob, his father, Israel, put him out in charge of his brothers. Joseph oversaw their work, reporting to his father the work and actions of his brothers. When Joseph was sold into slavery in Egypt, he became the caretaker and manager of Potiphar's house. Potiphar, we are told, left everything to the decision-making and behest of Joseph. Now here in prison, the chief jailer has put Joseph in charge of the prisoners. And Joseph has a gift. And as we read on, we might think that his gift is interpreting dreams. But what we are seeing consistently as a gift of Joseph is this: administration, management, strategic planning. And time again, folks recognize his gift and put him in a role where his gifts will be used. It may be that Jacob, and it probably is the fact that Jacob, his father, put him in charge of his brothers because he was his favorite son. But it could equally be true that his father saw in Joseph a capacity for management, for administration, for strategic planning. More on that in a second. And so two of the prisoners who are under his care in prison, they reach out to Joseph. Joseph is attentive to his role as caretaker in this prison, and he sees that the prisoners are having a bad day. They're sad. Their face shows that they are troubled by something. And so he reaches out to them, asking them, what's up, fellas? Why so downcast? Why the long faces? Well, they both speak of having dreams that trouble them. The first, the cupbearer of the king of Egypt, who we will learn is named Pharaoh. This cupbearer dreamed of a vine and of some branches that blossomed with grapes. He crushed the grapes. There were three vines, and he crushed the grapes, and he made wine, and he served it to Pharaoh. And Joseph says, oh, yeah, this is what that means. You know, the three vines means 3 days, and in 3 days, you're going to be restored back to your position, and you are going to serve the Pharaoh once again. Well, the baker, who also had a troubling dream, he had a dream, and he says, wait a minute, man, that sounds pretty good. He's getting restored. Let me go see if he can tell me what my dream is about. The chief baker, he dreamed a dream of having on his head three baskets of baked goods, and there were birds that were eating the baked goods, and Joseph is going to give this man an interpretation of his dream, and he's waiting eagerly, because surely as the cupbearer is getting his job back, the chief baker wants his job back. And Joseph tells this baker, your dream is this: after 3 days you're going to be executed and killed. Now, I wonder if there are other prisoners in the jail that had some dreams they wanted interpreted and thought to themselves, I'll keep my dreams to myself for the time being. And so Joseph interprets these two dreams by God's design, and Joseph told the prisoner who would be restored, now listen, you're going to be restored to the Pharaoh. I want you, when you get back to the Pharaoh, when you serve him his cup of wine, I want you to tell him about me. Tell him who I am, that I'm a good dude, that I don't deserve to be in this prison. Put in a good word for a brother so I can get out of here. And what happens? How did that turn out? Genesis chapter 40, verses 20. It says, on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast for all his servants and lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. He restored the chief cupbearer to the cupbearing and he placed the cup of Pharaoh in Pharaoh's hand. But the chief baker, he hanged, just as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. Not again. Seemingly betrayal by the cupbearer's bad memory. And here is Joseph, still stuck in prison. But as you continue to read, you see that this story is not over. Joseph's story will not end with him in prison. So moving to the next chapter, chapter 41, first several verses of chapter 41. After 2 whole years, Pharaoh dreamed that he was standing by the Nile, and there came up out of the Nile 7 sleek and fat cows, and they gazed in the reed grass. Then 7 other cows, ugly and thin, came up out of the Nile after them, and stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile. The ugly and thin cows ate up the 7 sleek and fat cows. And Pharaoh awoke. Then he fell asleep and dreamed a second time. 7 ears of grain, plump and good, were growing on one stalk. Then 7 ears, thin and blighted by the east wind, sprouted after them. The thin ears swallowed up the 7 plump and full ears. Pharaoh awoke, and it was a dream. In the morning, his spirit was troubled. So he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them to Pharaoh. Pharaoh was a powerful ruler of an important and powerful empire called Egypt. Now, we haven't spoken much about Egypt. Egypt was a great nation in northern Africa. It's still there, by the way. It was known for being superbly fertile. So agriculture, growing crops, was at its finest. Egypt was a center for learning and education. Writing and art were at a premium. Architecture was exquisite. Egyptians were on the cutting edge of scientific discovery, many noting their use of the sun to create calendars, precise calendars, thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago. And this great civilization was led by a ruler they called Pharaoh, which means great house. The Pharaoh served as the intermediary between the people and the gods of Egypt, which some suggest that there were over 2,000 gods in Egypt. And the great Pharaoh is troubled. He's having dreams, these awful dreams. And in a land that's full of these gods and full of these magicians and soothsayers, there is no one that can explain to him what these dreams mean. But enter the cupbearer whose memory is jogged, who remembers that when he was in prison, there was this young Hebrew who interpreted his dream, and perhaps he could be of some assistance to the Pharaoh. So he remembers what was done for him, and that initiates Pharaoh seeking out Joseph, chapter 41, verses 14. Then Pharaoh sent for Joseph, and he was hurriedly brought out of the dungeon. When he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret. I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Joseph answered Pharaoh, it is not I. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. Now, this is the second time that Joseph does not take credit for dream interpretation. He instead affixes that role to God. Dream interpretation is not a human act or gift. It is the work of God. Nevertheless, Joseph offers Pharaoh's God offers Pharaoh God's interpretation of his dream. In short, God revealed to Pharaoh that there were going to be 7 years of plenty where agriculture and growing crops is going to be at its finest. In fact, it was going to be more than good. But that was going to be followed by 7 years of famine. Dry, no drought. Crops are not going to grow as they should. And so in response to the dream, the interpretation that God gave, Joseph demonstrated and displayed his gifts. You remember what I said his gifts were? His gifts were what? Administration, management, strategic planning. And that is what you see throughout the rest of chapter 41. He advised Pharaoh to store up during the years of plenty, to take care of the years of famine. And so Pharaoh liked the idea so much that he put Joseph in charge of the effort. This is picking up in verse number 37 of chapter 41. The proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find anyone else like this, one in whom is the Spirit of God? So Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has shown you all this, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only with regard to the throne will I be greater than you. He basically exalted Joseph to second in command of all of Egypt. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt, removing his signet ring from his hand. Pharaoh put it on Joseph's hand. He arrayed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. He had him ride in the chariot of his second in command, and they cried out in front of him, bow the knee. Thus he set him over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no one shall lift up hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh gave Joseph the name Zephanath-Paneah, and he gave him Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, as his wife. Thus Joseph gained authority over the land of Egypt. As we read on, we learn that nations around the world came to Egypt, as the famine was not unique to Egypt. It was a worldwide famine, and Egypt was positioned to help not only its citizens, but the entire world. What a fascinating story and narrative that we now have this 30-year-old Joseph who has risen to power in the land that first recognized him as a slave. What does this say about God being with Joseph? What does this say about Joseph's resilient behavior in the face of difficulty, tragedy, and misfortune? 13 years. Remember, he's 17 years old when a lot of this started to unfold in his life. 13 years of heartache is now going to be followed by a life of plenty, success, significance, and the ability to get back at his brothers. We'll come back to that later on. For the first time, we walk away from the Joseph saga with life being good for Joseph. He has a new family. He has a new position. He's out of that pit. But still lingering is what got him there. A loss of identity. A loss of family. Sure, things look good, but are they really good? Resisting temptation has led Joseph to receiving a bigger and better assignment, and resilience will lead to a reshaping of narratives and possibly the restoration of that which is broken. Because of Joseph's resilience, Joseph is now positioned to save not just one nation, but all nations. That's a bigger and better assignment. Some have said that in essence, resilience means to bounce back. That is the story of Joseph in a nutshell. Misfortune happened and Joseph bounced back. Brothers hate you and sell you. God gave Joseph a spirit to bounce back. The master's wife falsely accuses you of a crime. You're thrown in a dark pity jail, but God gives you a spirit to bounce back. Joseph's faith was a resilient faith, enabling him to see God, feel God, and follow God no matter the circumstance. You know, my faith journey, I've been a Christian for several years, and I've served in three churches as a minister, and I have met hundreds, perhaps thousands of people that have just followed God and have shown and demonstrated a resilient faith. And among them, and a person that will continue to stand out is a woman that I met in Flint, Michigan. It was my first ministry job. I was the youth minister. It's a woman by the name of Doris Dunnigan. Doris Dunnigan was, when I got to Flint, Michigan, was a senior member. Christy went to that church and grew up with the Dunnigans, so she knew them very, very well. Before she was Doris Dunnigan, she was Doris Lawrence, and she was married to a man. They had a child that died as a child, then had another child that was born with spina bifida, had another child that was born with some neurological disorder they didn't know much about. Later on in life, they figured out that it was Parkinson's, had another daughter that just struggled with drug addiction and all types of issues, had another daughter that struggled with alcohol and some other things. And Doris, when she was married as a Lawrence, dealt with a husband that was a raging alcoholic who was abusive to her and abusive to the kids. It was just a bad situation. And it was enough for Doris, who was a Christian throughout all of this, to say, I give up. I am doing my very best to follow God, and I've got a husband that's treating me like dirt. I've got children that I can't have a healthy child, and it's just bad for me. She's one that can recognize what it means to be in the dark and in the deep pit. Doris Dunnigan is just such a resilient woman of faith, and things didn't work out with her husband. He would not give up the alcohol. He would not stop being abusive. She had to leave him. She ended up marrying a guy after divorcing that guy, marrying a guy by the name of Irv, who treated her like a queen, who treated her the way that a wife should be treated, and her faith continued to survive and flourish as she's in this new relationship. But things with their children didn't all go well. The one daughter who was addicted to drugs died. She took too much of some prescription medicine and died tragically. And there's a ton of other things that I could tell you about this family that are just tragic and tragic and tragic. But I'll never forget the many conversations I had with Miss Doris, where she always pointed back to her faith in God. It was her faith in God that got her through the death of a child of childhood cancer. It was her faith in God that got her through an abusive marriage. It was her faith in God that got her through the medical diagnoses of her two sons that now in their older age are dealing with these ailments. It was faith in God that got her through dealing with their her kids' kids and all those things. And she didn't dismiss the issues outright. She didn't pretend like they didn't exist. She didn't say that it didn't hurt to not have a really good family, the family like you see on TV that's all shiny with the 2.5 kids and white picket fence. She didn't say that there were no regrets or no sadness. She relied on her faith in God. She would often say, God, she would say, Dion, through it all, God has been with me. I think just a few years ago, Doris died and went on to glory. And I guarantee that God happily received this woman of this resilient faith. Church, the story of Joseph invites us to a life of resiliency, a life of staying faithful to him despite the circumstances, despite the hits that are going to come. There's a psychologist, her name is Dr. Lucy Hone. Dr. Lucy Hone has done years and years of research on resiliency. What is it that fuels a life of resiliency? And she's working not just from an academic vantage point. She's working from a real life vantage point as she has had to deal with grief. Her daughter and her best friend in a car were both tragically killed. And as she's working through grief and working through trying to get through the mourning process, not to put away the mourning, not to dismiss the mourning, but to continue to live life while she mourns, she studied resiliency, and she came up with these three ideas that seem to be the mark of those who are resilient. She says, those that are resilient, number one, accept that life happens. And that might seem, you know rudimentary, may sound, that's this idea that we accept that at any point, any of us can experience life and the tragedies that come with life. None of us are exempt from tragedy, from darkness, from misfortune. None of us are exempt from getting cancer. None of us are exempt from losing a loved one tragically. None of us are exempt from being the victim of a heinous crime. Like, life happens, and we have to accept that. Number two, she says, resilient people, they choose where they're going to exert their energy. Joseph, when he was in Potiphar's house, when he was in the jail, could have resorted to just going off into a corner and being by himself and exerting all his energy on his pity. But no, he had a gift, and he used that gift and exerted that energy. And because he did that, not only was it a demonstration of him being resilient in his faith, it had worldwide implications. So resilient people accept that life happens. They choose where to exert their energy. And the third thing is that they seek to engage in things that do good and not harm. And so in our mourning and in our grief over losses, not just the loss of loved ones, but the loss of opportunities or the loss of a lot of things, we're mourning a lot of things. It's not just the loss of people. But in our mourning, are we doing things that are good for us and not harmful to us? You see, that's Doris Dunnigan. When I think of Doris Dunnigan, I think of someone who says, I'm not the only one that has a sick, dying child. I'm not the only one that has an abusive husband. I'm not the only one. It's not a diminishing of her pain and her plight. It's an expression of a reality. Life happens. And so then she lives a life of doing good. such that the report of her, I'm not the only one that thinks so highly of Doris Dunnigan. Ask my wife about Doris Dunnigan. Ask the people we went to church with in Flint about Doris Dunnigan. She lived a life of doing good. And she did not resort to things that would harm herself or other people. It's a life of resiliency. And that's the life of Joseph, who, despite what happened to him, knew that God was with him, kept his faith in him. And we'll see how this impacted nations, and soon it will impact his family. And it's going to lead to healing. It's going to lead to restoration. But we'll talk about that in the next couple of weeks. The only way for us to hang on to a faith in God is to put our full hope, love, trust, peace in the hands of God. And so that's the invitation this morning. It's for us to put our only hope in Jesus, our only hope in God. The Hebrew writer would say it this way, that we run the race with perseverance. After listening to all the stories of those that place their faith in God, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and the sin that clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance. That's resilience. The race that is set before us. The only way for us to do that is to place our complete hope, trust, love, peace in the hands of God. As we're singing this song, there's a way that we can be helpful to you to help restore your hope in God, to help you live a life of a resilient faith. We would offer you to come as we stand and sing this song.